Part of the Boundless Audio Podcast Network. Part of the Boundless Audio Podcast Network.
It is so wonderful to look out at this room of people, 90% of whom are obligated to be here. So I also want to thank the History Center for inviting us back for the second year. It's always so wonderful to be here. They're a wonderful organization. Definitely check out their membership. And it doesn't make this any less special that we are the only women's history podcast in Rochester.
I mean, that we're aware of.
So welcome to Whining About Herstory, the Women's History Podcast, where two longtime besties whine about women that you probably haven't heard of, but definitely should have. I'm Emily.
I'm Kelly. And I mean, we don't have any wine today.
No, we're being, you know, it's a little early.
It's coffee, all coffee.
Yeah. So today what we are going to do is we are going to whine about some local Minnesota women. But first, we need to talk about us. So we are your mavens of ceremony. We have been doing this podcast for about 5 years. We are big ol' nerds, and we are not professional historians.
No.
So if you're listening to the story and you're like, I think it was actually this year, you're probably right, and we're probably wrong. And that's okay. It's okay to be wrong.
Yeah. So we met when we were in college. So that's, we've been friends for a very long time. And
we don't like to talk about numbers.
About the age.
So
yeah,
long
you
that
know.
We don't like to discuss numbers. It's tacky.
And yeah, it's been a crazy 5 years at least doing this podcast. So are you ready to jump in?
Let's do this.
Am I ready to jump in?
Because that's the real question. You're going first.
I will say you can listen to our podcast anywhere you listen to podcasts, Spotify, Apple. We're on all of them. I will also throw in that our standard podcast is not family friendly. This show is, but our standard podcast is probably not recommended for little ears. Okay, so today, make sure I'm on the right slide. I am covering Sarah Berger, later in life, Sarah Berger Stearns. And she was originally born in New York City in 1836 on November 30th. And she would move twice in her young life. First, her family would move to Michigan and then to Cleveland, Ohio. And everywhere Sarah went, she would notice, particularly in her schools, like, okay, I'm not being treated the same as the boys. And that's not okay.
That's so weird for the 1800s.
Did I say... Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, wait, no, what?
I thought they were so much more put together at that time.
I mean, you hope. So at the young age of 14, Sarah would actually get the chance to attend a women's rights convention held in Ohio, where she would get to hear Lucretia Mott and Lucy Stone and a bunch of other like women's suffrage leaders, like big names at the time. Which would really just inspire her to be like, hey, like, I want to look into this. I want to get people talking about the fact that we're not equal and this is not okay. And she would get started right away. This wasn't like, oh, I'm going to wait till I'm older. She was like, no, I'm going home. I'm the editor of my high school newspaper and I'm going to talk about this. And so she would put articles in the newspaper, and her first article after this, I'm trying to use the mouse. And the first article after this would be her talking about the fact that the University of Michigan would not enroll women. Not even, they wouldn't even consider it. Like, they were just like, nope, no women.
No girls allowed, written on a cardboard sign with a couple of backward letters.
I went the wrong direction.
Oh, wow.
I went to the end. See, we're not professionals, guys. Here we go.
This is a really good opportunity for our younger audience members to learn it's okay to make mistakes. And no, but Co-Buddy's nerfect.
So, yeah, the University of Michigan wouldn't allow women. And Sarah, when she was writing this article, she's like, I'm not going to sit idly by. Like, I want to be able to go to the University of Michigan. So 2 years before she could even apply, she started studying Greek and Latin, taking the preparatory classes that the boys would take in order to be able to attend university. There were four young ladies besides herself in these classes, and they would recite with the boys who were, again, preparing for these college. And at the end of these 2 years, they were declared by a university professor who had attended examinations of the men entering the college that they stood head and shoulders above some of the men that were applying. He was like, no, they know their stuff. They know what they're doing. you should let them in. And Sarah wanting to, you know, make sure that they had as many women as possible for as, like, as large of a group to be like, okay, hey, we're all going to apply at once. You know, it's harder to deny a group of people than it is to deny one. And so she reached out to other, like, women's schools and was like, hey, who, like, this is what I'm doing. There's five of us. Who wants to come with? And she got 11 more women that were like, yeah, we're prepared. We'll come with you. And so in the spring of 1858, she would send a note to the regents of the school saying, hey, we're going to apply. It wasn't even their actual application. She was just letting them know, we're sending in an application. So she said, yep, 12 of us are going to be applying in June to start this September. And a reporter actually said, a certain Miss B has sent the regents warning of this momentous event. And I thought it was funny that this reporter specifically was like, she sent him a warning. I'm like, that sounds like it's a threat, but maybe it is. So at the board meeting in June, the young ladies would show up and they would present their promise letter of application and receive a reply that they needed time to think about it, which is understandable. Like, this is a big deal. And in September, their reply was that it seemed inexpedient for the university to admit ladies at present.
I mean, we've all heard that from our parents, right? The like, I'm going to think about it. And the answer is no. We all know it is. Or like my parents would always say, well, let's pretend we did and then don't.
That's kind of harsh. Let's pretend we did and don't.
Well, it was when I want to go look at the toy aisle. Oh, okay, so it's totally reasonable. It had nothing to do with me wanting to go to school. I wouldn't have worked as hard as these women are. I would have been like,
you'd be like, oh, I can't go. Oh, that's a shame.
I want to watch the daytime Cartoon Network.
So I will say in those 3 months, there was a lot of discussion going on between when they sent their warning and when they applied. Faculty at the university were speaking about it. Some spoke in favor, some spoke against it. Students were getting in on it. The citizens of Ann Arbor, Michigan, where the university is located, were talking about it. And it ended up being very widely discussed in the press and on various platforms. The board was talking about it. Basically, everyone started talking about it. And even though their answer was no, it started a conversation that ended up being a yes. In 1869, eventually the university was like, okay, fine, we'll admit women. Okay, maybe you should be in charge of this because I'm not, because I keep going backwards because I keep trying to use it to control my computer.
It's this one, right?
Yes.
All right, great. See, this is when women get together and collaborate.
It's women
supporting
women.
Another great example to the young people in the audience.
You want to click one more slide? Beautiful. So yes, by 1869, women, but not Sarah, were admitted.
And none for Gretchen Wieners.
So Sarah would go on after this denial to the University of Michigan to accept a position teaching Greek and Latin, because obviously she just spent 2 years learning it, might as well use it. And after a year, she would apply to the University of Michigan again. Again, they still weren't accepting women at that time, so she got refused again. So she would enter and graduate from the State Normal School in Ypsilanti, Michigan. So she just was like, fine, if you're not going to take me, I'll go somewhere else. she would then marry a man named Lieutenant Azora P. Stearns, who is someone she had met 5 years previously, who was also advocating for women's rights at the time. So she kind of like fell in love with him and they kept in contact over those 5 years and would go on to get married.
What a king. Like, first of all, he's got the best name. Can we bring Azora back? I used to be a preschool teacher and I would love to look at a kid and be like, Azora, no running in the classroom. But then like he's supporting women's rights at a time where it's very unpopular for men to do so. Like, good for him.
He had a lot of weird looks if you're a man supporting women's rights at this time.
Yeah. Good for him though.
So shortly after their marriage, Azora would leave to fight for the Union Army in the American Civil War, and Sarah would teach at the Young Ladies Seminary in Monroe, Michigan. Her husband would actually briefly get stationed in St. Paul, and he actually wrote Sarah a letter while he was in St. Paul being like, hey, I miss you. Can you come and visit me? So she would go very briefly to St. Paul, but then return to Detroit, Michigan. And when he was sent south, Sarah was like, no, I'm going to do other stuff while you're gone. I'm not just going to like sit around and pine for you. So she would involve herself in providing aid throughout the war. She would visit hospitals and like learn what they did and what was necessary for them to do. She would enlist as an active worker in the Sanitary Commission for the North. And this was a group of women performing a variety of tasks. They raised money for food and uniforms, and they would actually compete with men, like men doing the same work for army contracts to manufacture military clothing. And they actually won a lot of the contracts because a lot of people, you know, the view was kind of sexist because they were like, oh, it's women making clothing versus men making clothing. The women are probably better at it, but still it kind of, it gave a lot of women that like freedom of like, hey, if we band together, if we can be these women supporting women, we can do stuff.
It's also a great example of how sexism also hurts men.
So
men can sew too.
She would also give a lot of lectures during this time, ranging from war aid to dress reform for women. She would lecture at the Soldiers Aid Society and the Theodore Parker Fraternity. Her lecture was titled Wrongs of Women and Their Redress, which was, yeah, just about like how things should change so women can be equal. At the end of the war, Sarah would wait for her husband to be relieved from service. She would teach freed Black Americans where her husband, who is now a colonel, was stationed. So basically she was like, well, I'm here anyways. I might as well like do something good. And then they would move to Minnesota. Specifically, they would move to Rochester, Minnesota.
Yes. This is where the story gets good.
So during this time, her husband would become Olmsted County's attorney, and then he would become mayor of Rochester for 2 years. But the story isn't about him. That's the background to what Sarah was doing at this time. So the first year they moved here, Sarah was actually asked to give a speech on, quote, our young and growing state, may she ever be an honor to her citizens. This was at a 4th of July celebration, and Sarah, as one does, took this opportunity to discuss women's suffrage and women's rights. Apparently, it was actually pretty well received, and it actually like got a lot of cheers. And an old gentleman, I was reading a newspaper article, and an old gentleman actually said, like, oh, this gives us something fresh to think about and something to act upon.
Remember when this was a hot take? Maybe still a hot take.
Yeah, I was like, it's coming back. Sarah would continue to give lectures during this time, too, on things such as the women in the home and women in the Republic. She would also write a lot of newspaper articles during this time, which I was really sad that I couldn't find a lot of them. I found some, but I couldn't find a lot of them. And I was kind of like, oh, that's really sad that like it was a Rochester Post thing. And I'm sure I could probably go to the library and find like microfilm, but I'm sorry, I'm not that dedicated.
Or perhaps the Olmsted County History Center archives. Get your membership now. Shameless plug.
Nice plug. That was beautiful. Yeah. Not paid
hey,
to say
I,
that.
I know who invited us here. I know who butters my bread.
So through these newspaper articles that were not only circulated in Rochester, but through the rest of the state, Sarah would connect with a woman named Mary Jackman Colburn, who was another very active suffragist in Minnesota. She lived in Champlin specifically, and Mary's actually thought to be the first woman to give a public lecture in Minnesota on women's rights that was called Rights and Wrongs of Women. So yeah, she's banding together with other women that are doing the same thing she is. And together, Sarah, Mary, and other women that Sarah just titled Friends of Equality. I couldn't find their names anywhere. It literally was just like other people that supported suffrage. I was like, all right. They would petition the Minnesota legislature for an amendment to strike the word male from the section of the Minnesota state constitution, which enfranchised every male person. So they just wanted to say every person. Just take the word male out of it as a means to provide women with the right to vote. Very sneaky way to provide women with the right to vote, but very easy. Just cross a word off, guys.
As someone who does editing and gets paid for it, it is very simple. It's not that hard.
Right. Just, you know, white out.
It was harder to make this slide than it would be to just like draw the little circle.
So Sarah and Mary were given a hearing. Like they actually were allowed to come and speak before the legislature. Unfortunately, due to some like really weird and confusing scheduling, which again, very modern take there, Sarah wasn't able to like attend because they told her one day and then they changed it. But she was able to write a letter, which was then presented in her absence. And Mary was actually able to go and speak in chambers at the legislature. Unfortunately, the bill would fail by a vote of one, which makes me so mad, and no action would be taken. 2 years later, Susan B. Anthony, who was like the head of the national movement, the National Women's Suffrage Association, was traveling through the Midwest, stopped in Minnesota. She was basically doing rounds encouraging women to form local suffrage unions under the National Women's Suffrage. And after her visit, Sarah and Mary, who had been very fortunate to meet her, formed the first two suffrage societies in Minnesota. Sarah started hers, obviously, in Rochester with 50 members, and Mary started hers in Champlin. I could not find the number of members that she had, but...
Not enough, probably.
Not enough, exactly.
Should be everyone.
So just months after these two suffrage societies were created, Sarah's Rochester suffrage group and Mary's Champlin group would circulate petitions separately that would then be combined, and total they would have 750 signatures for a bill that was sent to the House first, and it resulted in House File 123, which was a bill proposing, quote, that suffrage be extended to every person of at least 21 years of age who had lived in the United States for a year and in the state of Minnesota for a minimum of 4 months. This includes natural citizens, immigrants who declare an intention to become citizens, Native Americans, and other individuals who agree to comply with the U.S. customs and laws. Pretty straightforward. So, like, this bill is not only women's suffrage, but it's like, let's just let everyone who calls Minnesota home vote. So the bill was introduced on February 9th, and it would pass the House on February 15th, 33-13. So actually by a pretty wide margin. And you may be thinking like, oh, good job, like Minnesota House of Representatives, like so progressive. Sadly, that's not the case. This vote was kind of viewed as a huge joke. People were like, oh, this, what, like, we'll just let women have their thing, but it's never actually going to pass. Also, a lot of the legislators were quick to like very publicly explain, like, I only voted yes because I want the people to vote on it. You know, it was like, I wouldn't vote on it, but I want you guys to choose. You know, it was very much like, I'm passing it, but I don't want my hands in this.
They're like, that sounds like a you problem.
Yes, very, very much so. So the newspapers, when they found out the House had passed this, they were not happy. They were upset, and the quote I found was this, quote, the House has passed the proposed women's suffrage amendment to the Constitution with the proviso that women shall be allowed to vote on the question of its adoption, their ballots to be received in separate boxes and counted by themselves. This is indeed carrying this joke a little too far, and it is sincerely to be hoped that the Senate will preserve the state from ridicule and odium, which is hatred or disgust. I had to look that one up, which is sure to follow. So basically, yeah, the newspaper is like, okay, guys, like, we know that you view this as a joke. Like, you're taking it too far. If we pass this, like, all the other states are going to make fun of us. Like, let's not do this.
I think we can take a moment for everyone to collectively just, like, unclench every part of their body from rage.
Deep breathing.
Just, it got better. Spoiler, it got better.
I do also find it funny that basically, they talk about, like, not only are we trying to get the women the right to vote, but we're trying to get women the right to vote on the right to vote. Like, that was part of the bill, too, is that women can vote on whether or not this amendment passes. So it was very interesting. But it would pass the Senate on February 24th with a vote of 12-9. Like their counterparts in the House, the senators justified their actions very much the same way, by basically being like, you know what, I'm going to leave it in the hands of the people. It's not on me. So this sounds incredibly democratic, but these men, if you go back and read a lot of the articles surrounding this, these lawmakers truly believe that the public would vote no, like overwhelmingly vote no. And they were like, if we put it to the public and they vote no, the issue's done. We don't have to talk about it anymore, because if the public doesn't want it, why do we have to keep bringing it up?
And then they get to say, well, we didn't say no.
Exactly.
They said no. So cute.
Yeah. So they were very much just like, you know what? I don't think the state's going to pass it. So we'll just leave it up to the people. So the bill would reach the governor of Minnesota at the time, named Horace Austin. He was a judge, but it would land on his desk. And he was thought to be a pro-suffrage individual. So he surprised everyone by vetoing this bill. Did not let it through. He said, this bill was not passed in good faith, that the submission of the question is premature. He said the bill was illegal and would not let the public vote on it. Just straight up was like, nope, this is done.
Shut it down.
Exactly. So his argument for the legality of the bill was that women are not allowed to vote. Shocking. So therefore, it is illegal for them to vote on this amendment, which was part of the bill, was that the women could vote if this amendment passed or not. And he was just like, well, we can't let them do that because that's illegal. So therefore, this bill is illegal.
The verbal gymnastics. Does anyone have Tylenol? My head.
This was like the section I read like six times. I'm like, does this make sense? Because I don't know.
But what if he knows that we know? But what if he knows that we know that he knows? Like, it just keeps going. It's turtles all the way down. It's ridiculous.
It's turtles all the way down. So he would actually send a private letter to Sarah after vetoing the bill. And he would say, quote, had the bill provided for the voting of women simply to get an expression of the women's wishes upon the question, without requiring their votes to be legal in the adoption or rejection, the act would not have been vetoed, notwithstanding my second objection that this was premature. So basically he's like, had you said like, oh, you women can vote, but it's just a suggestion, it's not a legal thing, it would have been fine. But then he also came back in letters to other people that basically he was like, I was opposed to the entire idea. I never would have passed the bill, period. So a little bit of, you know, back and forth. So there's a lot of like speculation on why he vetoed the bill. There's a direct quote from him about not trusting foreign voters. And that's not saying like people even outside the country. It's saying people outside of Minnesota. That's what he was talking about for foreign voters. And he actually said, quote, 3/5 of our population are of foreign birth and are hostile to the measure to a man, and most of them bitterly so.
Like, I know we all have strong opinions about Wisconsin, but that doesn't mean that they shouldn't get to vote.
Right. And it doesn't mean we all hate, you know, we don't hate all of them, just like 60%.
Yeah, yeah, a healthy amount. Don't get me started on Iowa.
Yeah. And so it was either because of that or because of the legality. Like I said, he never let the public vote on it. So my favorite part about reading this section, because I was really, really mad, but there was a senator from St. Anthony named William Loughran who basically came back and was like, so you're saying this bill is illegal. What you're doing, not letting the public vote on this bill, is also illegal. Because at the time, the U.S. Constitution, or not the U.S., the Minnesota Constitution had a thing that actually said any amendment to the Constitution must be voted on by the public after it passes the House and the Senate. So, yeah, this senator was like, so you technically can't block the vote. Like, that is illegal to our Constitution as well. But the veto was upheld and the public vote never took place. Had Minnesota voters been able to vote on it, and had we accepted it, Minnesota would have been the first state since 1807 to grant suffrage to women through the popular electoral vote, but we didn't get that status because
we were so close to greatness. Just this close. Also, I know your slides are kind of an artist interpretation,
yeah,
but I really hope that's how it went down. Judge Horace is like, this bill's illegal. You're illegal.
You're illegal.
Is illegal.
You know, that's my headcanon of, yeah, exactly what happened. So a few years later, the Stearnses would move to Duluth, probably for her husband's law career. Didn't really figure it out.
I mean, Duluth is just gorgeous this time, yeah, of year, isn't it?
It's all those lake views. So Sarah would immediately almost organize another suffrage society in Duluth. So she would organize the Duluth Women's Suffrage Circle and would serve as president until 1893. So 21 years. She would also at this time work to support the temperance movement. For our younger audience members, the temperance movement was basically, it was a prohibition movement. They didn't want drinking. They wanted to outlaw drinking.
They wouldn't have liked us.
It was also very closely tied to the religion at the time. And yeah, so she very strongly supported the temperance movement, which was very common in a lot of like suffrage circles. And she would serve as the secretary and chair of the resolutions committee for the first Women's Christian Temperance Union State Convention, which is a mouthful. And during this time, when she's doing all these activities, a local newspaper would write about Sarah and say, she is a power in the young community of Duluth, as well as in the state of Minnesota. So like people are recognizing like, okay, yeah, she's a great speaker. She's really good at like getting people together, getting people to listen to her.
She's kind of a big deal.
She's kind of a big deal. I almost said big deal, and I'm like, that doesn't make any sense here. In 1875, an amendment to the Minnesota Constitution was proposed to allow women of 21 years and older to vote in, very specifically, quote, any election held for the purpose of choosing officers of schools or upon any measure relating to schools, and may also provide that any women shall be eligible to hold any office pertaining solely to the management of schools. So very, very specific in that women can vote in school elections. But also the bigger part of this bill is actually that like women could hold school board office now, which had obviously not been done before. So I loved Sarah's tactic for this because Sarah and other supporters of the bill made no campaign effort whatsoever. They were like, we're going to stay silent because, as Sarah put it, quote, no effort was made to agitate the question lest more should be affected in rousing the opposition than in educating the masses. So she's like, if we try to tell people about this vote, the people that don't want this vote to pass are going to get louder and louder. And we're giving, if we give voice to our opinions, it's going to give a louder voice to their opinions. So we're just not going to talk about it.
Keep it on the DL.
Yes. And so shortly before the election, Sarah actually would contact an editor of the Pioneer Press up in St. Paul and would be like, hey, can we like just run a tiny little article about the vote? And he would actually respond by admitting that he had forgotten the vote was taking place at all. So like Sarah's job was definitely like working. The other thing that Sarah and her colleagues did was they talked to both political parties and changed the phrasing on the ballot. So I'm assuming prior to this, it would say like, so they changed it to the wording was this: for the amendment of Article 7 relating to electors, dash, yes. I'm assuming it normally says dash, no, and then you have to change it to yes if you want to vote for it. But this meant that in order to vote against this amendment, you have to cross out yes and write no. And historian William Watts Falwell probably wrote my favorite quote on this, and it was this, quote, opposers were thus obligated to unbutton their coats, get out their glasses, fumble for a pencil, and cross out yes and write no. So this amendment would actually pass. It would pass 24,340 to 19,468, which that meant 19,468 people actually like were like, okay, I'm going to take the time to mark this. But also, like, if you think about it, this is not the first time, and it's probably not the last time that a bill got passed because people didn't read the wording of it.
Yeah, and that never happened again in Minnesota. Definitely not in recent history. If
no,
you know, you know.
So Sarah would go on to say, our bitterest opponents forgot that the question was even being voted upon, and the ignorant classists who could not or would not read their ballots voted unthinkingly for the measure. Because, yeah, if you think about it, if you're so used to everything saying no, you're just going to read right past it and be like, oh, yeah, sure, whatever. Like, you're not going to, if you don't take the time to read it, you're not going to realize they changed the wording.
I'm feeling a lot more thankful for our modern ballots that just, like, you fill in the little bubble and then you put it in the machine and you're done. I don't have to think about that.
It's minimal effort.
You just pick, you close your eyes, you pick a circle. And
please don't vote that way.
Aren't you so glad we got the right to vote?
Yeah. So after the passage of this amendment, Sarah would speak at women's meetings all over the state, informing them of their new rights and campaigning for two female candidates from Minneapolis that immediately were like, yeah, I want to be on the school board. The following year, a woman named Charlotte O'Sconson, it's not Wisconsin, it's OU, it's Wisconsin, but OU instead of W at the beginning, but Clark Van Cleve, so Charlotte Van Cleve would become the first woman elected to the Minneapolis school board, which is super exciting. Sarah herself in the following years would run and serve on the Duluth School Board for about 3 years, and she was the first woman elected to Duluth School Board. And so when this amendment to allow women to vote on there was an amendment to allow women to vote on matters relating to prohibition. It was called the Whiskey Law, which I was like, okay.
You almost had me there.
Yeah.
You almost had me, yay.
Yeah. But yeah, like, it basically, yeah, a lot of men were like, no, like, we don't, because women's suffrage was so tied to temperance that it got almost immediately voted down. It did not pass very far because, yeah, the men were like, we don't want women saying we can't drink, which I kind of understand.
I also don't want women saying we can't drink. I don't want anyone.
But that amendment, because the temperance movement was a lot more widespread than women's suffrage at the time, which is a little sad, but that really, it made other people, other women in Minnesota really like recognize, okay, like we need to have a bigger movement. Like there needs to be more traction if we want our voices to be heard. And so that led to Sarah and 13 other prominent women, including Mary Colburn. They were at a temperance meeting in Hastings, Minnesota, and they decided to create the Minnesota Women's Suffrage Association, or the MWSA. Sarah was elected as the first president, which was very smart because under her leadership, the number of members in that first year doubled and then doubled again the year after. And she was unanimously reelected as the MWSA president at its first annual meeting and would have been unanimously elected for a third year, but she had to step down due to ill health, but she would accept the presidency of the Equal Rights League in Duluth. She would still often attend the Suffrage Association meetings, giving speeches and different lectures throughout the years and at conventions. So aside from suffrage, Sarah was doing a bunch of other really amazing things in Duluth. One of the big ones was founding the Ladies Relief Society, which she created in her own words, a home for women needing a place of rest and training for self-help and self-protection. So this was during a time in Minnesota and Duluth's history that the population like tripled in like 2 years. It was very crazy. And Sarah was concerned with a lot of the young women that she would see that were left alone without husbands, many with babies, no means of livelihood, no training, no families to help them. And basically she was like, okay, I want to be able to help these women. And so she created these homes. And for about 2 years, the home was run by Sarah and a small committee of other women in the area who would provide care for these families. The families were boarded in different places throughout Duluth just because they didn't have a central location, and the women would supply funds through the committee. They would also help these women find training and employment, as well as educating the children. Eventually, a formal organization was created and the home was founded. And Sarah was its president and would help maintain the various locations. And it would become at this time known as Home for Women and Children, or Duluth's Home for Women and Children. They would open quarters at the back of a store and hire a full-time caretaker, mainly to look after the children, but also to care for the rooms. 5 to 6 years later, a new home, an actual home, was built on property donated by Sarah's husband and another judge in the area named Judge Einson. And a lot of the funds were donated by other members of the society. And at this time, the home would become known as the Duluth Children's Home Society. And this organization has actually continued and expanded to this day. It's still around, still with the same mission. It's switched focus a little bit from like helping women and their children to more being just about the children. But like that core, like let's help the citizens of Duluth and of Minnesota and stuff like that is still very much there. And today it is actually known as the Northwood Children's Services.
Thank you, Sarah.
Yeah. So in 1894, the Stearnses would move to California because Azora's health was declining. And, you know, you go someplace nice and sunny and warm when your health declines.
I think that would also help my health.
I'm still voting for the south of France.
I want
that doctor's note for the south of France.
Yeah.
So during this time, Sarah would chair the Los Angeles Suffrage League. Like, she's still, like, out there doing the things, and she would continue to work on women's rights until her own death in January 26, 1904, from what I saw in a news article was a bleed on her brain, so probably some sort of aneurysm or stroke or something like that, unfortunately. In her obituary, Sarah is called one of the most prominent platform orators in the cause of women's suffrage and temperance, not in Minnesota, period.
Could we just take a second? Who has heard of Sarah before this?
It's three hands.
We got three hands. This was a woman who was called one of the most prominent platform orators in the cause of women's suffrage and temperance. We don't know her.
Yeah. She was also characterized in a different, or sorry, She was, yeah, characterized in a different newspaper that said she possessed the tenacity of purpose, the dogged persistence of a true reformer. No discouragements, rebuffs, or ingratitude seemed to downhearten her or swerve her from what she considered right. This was at a time when suffragists in general were often dismissed, ridiculed, and mocked. They had to be made of stern stuff, and Sarah Stearns passed the test or lived up to her name. She organized many local and state societies. She orchestrated the first legislative success for suffrage in Minnesota and bombarded the state legislature with petitions that I all talked about. And she obviously was very charismatic and invaluable to the early days of suffrage in general and in Minnesota. In 1996, Minnesota did put together a memorial garden that is built on the grounds of the Minnesota State Capitol. It is still there today. You can go.
They built it. And there's a bus out front for all of us right now.
Yeah, let's go. This was to observe the 75th anniversary of the suffrage movement. There's a garden there that is called the Garden of Time, Landscape of Change. It is planted with Minnesota native flowers and grasses. And in the garden, there's a monument that lists the names of 25 of like the original founding members of suffrage in Minnesota, including Sarah. Yeah. So that was Sarah Berger Stearns and everything she did. Mainly in Minnesota.
I love how throughout the story, it was like, she moved here and she started doing stuff. And then she moved here and she started doing more stuff.
This is a woman who did not know what rest was.
Even hearing that, I was exhausted. I'm like, I need a nap. She can't stop and won't stop. And I'm very thankful for that.
Yeah.
Ooh, I get to talk now.
Yeah. It's your turn. Who are you whining about?
So today I am whining about the Wilmer 8 because I love a good group project. You know, where everyone
you
actually...
You might be like the only person that loves a good group project.
I might be the only person who's heard of a good group project. So, imagine this. December 16th, 1977, small town Wilmer, Minnesota, in the dead of winter. Snow covers the ground, not the fluffy romantic snow, but snow which has been frozen solid to the point where falling on it might actually shatter your bones. The wind chill with the temperature is negative 70 degrees Fahrenheit.
Sounds like a bit of an exaggeration.
It was true, though. But, you know, there was still that one guy walking around in a hoodie and shorts.
And flip-flops.
And his flip-flops. He was fine. So this is absurd, even for us hardy Minnesotans who have snow and ice coursing through our veins. But eight brave women ventured out into this snowmageddon, marching outside the Citizens National Bank, bundled from head to toe, holding picket signs, reading things like unfair labor practices, strike, and we protest slave labor.
I just get this image of like women. I mean, they're not, but like the image I got in my head was like them bundled up like the Michelin Man, just like little like marshmallows with sticks.
So these women who had become known as the Wilmer Eight were Doris Bouchart, Irene Whalen, Sylvia Erickson Cole, Jane Hargith Gruthus, Sandy Tremel, Tara Novotny, Shirley Solentis, and Glennis Terwisha. And they were striking against the Citizens National Bank in Wilmer, Minnesota. So what sparked this Sub-Zero strike force? The 1970s were a pretty wild decade. Great strides had been made for the civil rights movement in the 60s, including the passage of the Equal Pay Act. And now the women's liberation movement was in full swing.
Woohoo!
Yay! Yay, progress! However, because there's always a but.
Yeah, always.
Sexism and sex discrimination in the workplace was still going strong, including at the Citizens National Bank in Wilmer, Minnesota.
I think about, how... Like those things were bad all over, but I feel like in small towns, they got even worse.
Yeah. So there were some stark differences between male and female
blank employees.
Who here has ever worked at a blank? That sounds like my resume. I just like leave it blank.
Just your name, just blank piece of
paper. I would like to work at blank because blank. It's the world's worst Mad Lib. So there were some stark differences between male and female bank employees, such as... pay inequality. The average starting salary for men at the bank was $700 a month, which is almost $3,000 today, while the starting salary for women was $300 a month, which is about $1,200 today. So to put this in perspective, $700 a month is what one of the strikers had worked her way up to over 10 years. So it took her 10 years to reach the same salary as a man who had just started. In addition to this pay inequality, the only female officer at the bank earned $4,000 less than the men she supervised. Unpaid overtime was another issue. Female employees were required to work overtime without pay. That pay, which is already less.
I feel like this bank made like a 180. They were like, okay, if we're allowing women into the workforce, we're going to make them work extra. Like, they're never allowed to be home. If they're going to be here, they're never allowed to be home. Exactly.
You wanted to be here so badly. Understandably, animosity among the female employees had been stirring for a while. One of the strikers, Doris Beauchart, said, "We talked about it amongst ourselves all the time, and it just kept growing and growing, and we kept getting angrier and angrier."
As they should.
Understandably so. So things came to a head in April of 1977. The female employees were told to train new male employees who were hired at a better wage to become their bosses. Because God forbid you have women supervising men.
Or, you know, women supervising women.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely not.
No, it
has
to be a man supervising everyone.
I mean, okay. Calm down. You're getting a little hysterical right now. When the women confronted the bank president, Leo Persh, over this and the ongoing discrimination, he told them, "We're not all equal, you know." And that men needed more money to pay for dates. Honestly, if I met a guy who was spending $2,000 on our dates, it might take the sting out of the pay inequity a little bit. Like, if a guy shows up to my door with a cat on a golden toilet, I'm like, that's fine. That's fine. You want my right to vote too? Let's do this. So not satisfied with their boss's flawless logic.
Obviously.
That May, the women filed a gender discrimination complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or the EEOC, and filed an unfair labor practice charge with the National Labor Relations Board. And in addition to these efforts, the women formed Minnesota's first bank union.
Woohoo!
These are not actual archival pictures. That June, the EEOC unsurprisingly determined that there was reasonable cause to believe that there had been gender discrimination, and the bank's board of directors agreed to negotiate with the women. Yay! However, as Terwisha, one of the strikers, recalled, the negotiations were a, quote, absolute effort in futility. The bank president would sit reading the newspaper at the bargaining table, and they had no intention of going anywhere.
He clearly forgot his cats and gold toilets.
Yeah, right?
Just one for each woman, and then it would have been fine. It would have been fine.
This strike never even had to happen. You just needed to give out a bunch of cats on gold toilets. We would have been great. So since nothing came of that, on December 16th, 1977, eight women ventured out in the sub-zero weather and began picketing the bank. The women were not super excited to picket the bank in negative 70 degree weather and hoped that the strike would end within a few weeks. Many of them felt that this all could have been avoided had the bank just paid their employees equally in the sum of three cats and a gold toilet each. Unfortunately, as Tara Novotny, one of the strikers, said, quote, they weren't going to let a bunch of female employees tell them what to do.
Yeah. Well, I also think about, I wonder how much the bank was relying on like public opinion, because Wilmer's a small town. Like, so people are going to notice these women outside the bank. And I wonder if they're just like, oh, their husbands will shut it down, or like, you know, community outcry will shut it down.
Oh, we'll get to it.
Oh, I know.
Though the women hoped the strike would end quickly, it ended up dragging on for nearly 2 years. Thankfully, it was not negative 70 degrees the whole time, but still a huge pain in the butt. Despite the women never sending out a press release or soliciting any kind of publicity about the strike gained national attention and was seen as part of the larger women's liberation movement of the time. the Wilmer 8 received cards, letters, and donations in support from all over the world. An anonymous woman from New Zealand donated $5 every month to the strike fund, and one letter read, "You can't stop. You understand, you can't stop. Please understand that you're doing this for all of us."
Yeah, it no longer just became about like these eight women and this bank. It came about like women's equality and pay in general, not even in just the United States. Like, everyone was just like, "You need to do this for us," which is a lot of pressure.
It's a lot of pressure, but I think it's also a testament to how universal this feeling of inequality amongst women were.
Yeah.
You know, this wasn't just happening in Wilmer, Minnesota. And while these women were incredibly brave and strong for doing this, their feelings were not unique.
No. And in a way like that, I think about like the validation that probably came from that, like receiving that support, receiving it and from everywhere to be like, okay, no, we are doing the right thing. And how much, like, I know for me, like that would bolster me to keep going for 2 years, you know, otherwise after like 3 weeks, I'd be like, I'm done. I'm bored.
As someone who needs constant validation, I also think that would be really helpful. Thank you so much for laughing.
$5 every month.
Yeah.
Monetary validation, $5
every
month.
I do appreciate monetary validation too. So the women were featured in magazines and on TV shows, including the Today Show. Ever heard of it? Actress Lee Grant actually showed up at the picket line and made a documentary about the women, which you can probably find online. And Terwisha said of the documentary, quote, "There's something that pulls me to it, only because every time I see it, I still cry. And I realize that as the tears are coming to my eyes at certain points, I look around and I see I'm not alone. I feel the welling of support again. It re-energizes and gives me some wonderful reminders that I can't believe that I was a part of that." She goes on to say, "It wasn't very long before it wasn't our strike anymore. The National Organization for Women, or NOW, was also supportive, sending additional people to support them on the picket line." So it went from these eight, like, Minnesota moms, we can all imagine these women, to this national movement that they didn't even ask for.
Yeah, like they were like, I literally didn't ask for. Like people just started showing up and they were like, all right.
At first, the Wilmer 8 looked at the NOW activists with suspicion. Feminism was a dirty word that conjured images of bra-burning, hysterical, man-hating hippie women who braided their pit hair and looked down on any woman who decided to stay at home. Thank God we've moved past these perceptions in modern day. However, the Wilmer 8 came to realize that the activists were fighting to give women more choices rather than telling them how to live their lives. Yeah. Which I think is incredible too, that perception of what feminism is. And the Wilmer 8 became accidental feminists.
Right. And well, you think about like that, it still happens today, that like the perception people have and like that like, do I really want to be associated with this movement? Like, is it okay? And then like having that realization of like, no, like they are supporting the same things I'm supporting, and it is okay for me to have that label, even if other people are going to maybe not like it.
Yeah. It's all about choice. For example, after the show, if you would like to burn your bra, we have a fire pit out back, but you don't have to. Striker Terwisha recalled, "It was like a light bulb came on in my head. It was like, wow, I get it. I understand." In February, the United Automobile Workers held a support rally for the Wilmer 8, which was attended by more than 250 people. And Terwisha recalled, "They were friends, they were supporters, and they did this without being asked." And that's the part that blows my mind.
Yeah.
We had to ask a lot of people to show up for this. They didn't ask for any of this. However, while the nation was falling in love with these eight spunky Minnesota gals, the issue was highly controversial and seemed to split the town's 14,000 citizens.
Yeah.
Wilmer, Minnesota had never seen anything like this and couldn't even believe the strike was happening in the first place, let alone going on for 2 years. While some townspeople supported the women, honking as they drove past the strikers, others were actively harmful. Local businesses blacklisted the strikers for years. Their children lost friends, and one striker's marriage crumbled. The lawyer John Mack, who was representing the women, was removed from his position as the GOP county chair. And to his credit, he stuck with the case. He said, quote, "They were right. And I didn't conceive of it then. And I still don't conceive of it now as this being a partisan issue."
So I have to say, like, as someone who does obviously a lot of women's history research, I'm always so happy when there is a man that is like this incredibly supportive, because I've seen time and time again, and Emily has too, that yeah, someone will be with them until it gets hard for them. And then they're like, yeah, you know what? You're on your own now. So the fact that he's just like, you know what? This is, everyone deserves a fair pay. Like it doesn't matter what party you're a part of or anything like that. Like it just pay them what they deserve.
It was right then and it's right now. So there were also 5 female employees with the bank who didn't strike and remained working there. And I do not blame them at all. Mm-mm. The bank began to suffer financial losses due to townspeople ceasing their support. They dropped from an annual growth of 12% to 6%. So I'll cry for the bank for a moment.
Moving on.
Remarking on the citizens of Willmar turning their backs on the bank, Doris Beauchart said, "I think they were ashamed that they let us stand out there for 2 years."
Yeah.
As they should be.
When you think about like that awkward moment, every single time you wanted to like deposit at the bank, you have to go through this like picketing line of women.
Line.
And I would be like, no, I can literally bank anywhere else.
I'm just going to keep my money in a shoebox under my bed.
Exactly.
I mean, a different location that I didn't just say out loud. Though the bank could have ended the strike by simply agreeing to pay the women equally, they instead tried to leverage their own power against the strikers. They put, quote, "the financial squeeze" on a nearby gas station where the women would take bathroom breaks, forcing them to bar the women.
That's so gross.
You do not mess with women and their bathroom.
No.
We travel in herds and we will not be stopped. As the strike dragged on, it was taking an emotional toll on the women, and strike funds were shrinking. In the summer of 1978, the Willmar 8 dropped their discrimination lawsuit against the bank and settled for a small financial settlement, which was brokered by the EEOC. By September of that year, their strike funds were gone, and the strikers dropped their demands entirely, offering to return to work without a contract. The bank had already filled the 8 women's positions and told them that they could reapply as openings became available. One of the strikers, Doris Beauchart, was allowed to immediately return to the bank, but instead of returning to her position as head bookkeeper, she was demoted to teller. Beyond this, the other bank employees were abusive and constantly harassed her. 4 of the other strikers were able to return to the bank, but they didn't stay for more than a few months.
It's like they could have started like a new lawsuit all over again after starting, because they're like, okay, like they're now harassing us for the thing that we did. Like we reported them and now we're getting harassed, which is also illegal.
But again, they've been doing this for 2 years and got nowhere. They have
tired.
No more money. They're tired. The bank was always going to be able to outlast them.
Yeah.
In the summer of 1979, the Honorable E. Dorian Gladson of the National Labor Relations Board found that the Citizens National Bank was guilty of unfair labor practices, but, or don't you just love that word when it comes up in a sentence?
No, I hate it. I hate it so much.
They also ruled that the unfair practices did not cause the strike and that the strike was economic. Yeah, because they're not getting paid.
I know, I'm like, I have questions for this honorable judge to be like, okay, like, why? That's the main question, honestly.
Right. Because of this, the Willmar 8 were not entitled to back pay or getting their jobs back. So economic strikers are those who are trying to gain an economic concession from their employer, like higher wages, better hours, or improved working conditions. The strikers retain their status as employees, but the employers are allowed to replace them. So if the employer has hired a permanent replacement, the striker is not entitled to their job back. This is opposed to unfair labor practice strikers who strike against unfair labor practices. In this case, the employer cannot fire or permanently replace the strikers. Was that confusing? It was for me too.
Yeah. So the way I, maybe you sum it up, but it sounds like the women striked because of unfair labor practices that caused an economic concession.
Yeah.
But the judge was like, no, you want higher pay, therefore it's an economic thing, therefore you don't get anything.
It was a lot of legalese for sorry, not sorry.
Yeah.
Despite this ruling that I literally cannot wrap my head around, the Wilmer 8 held the picket line into the fall until eventually the strike fizzled and ended.
That's so impressive. 2 years.
That's longer than most anything I've ever done.
I was about to be like, that's longer than most podcasts.
Yeah.
Because there are stats that podcasts last about a year.
So Doris Beauchart, the one striker who was allowed to return to the bank, stuck it out. And according to a 2009 article, still worked at the bank, though it's now Heritage Bank. I wonder why they rebranded. Hmm. It's not like there was any negative publicity surrounding the Citizens National Bank.
Not at all.
Aside from the small settlement, the Wilmer 8 never received any financial gain from the strike. Whoop. Can I go back?
Yeah, you just gotta put the mouse.
There we go. Despite having lost the battle, the Wilmer 8 contributed to the large-scale fight for gender equality in the workplace. One of the strikers, Tara Novotny, recalled that her mother-in-law saw increased respect for women in the bank where she worked.
Yeah, it was kind of that like ripple effect of like other banks are like, ooh, let's not have that be us.
The Wilmer 8 still received letters and phone calls from college students learning about the case, honoring their sacrifices and struggles with which contributed to them being able to pursue an education and greater workplace equality.
We're still getting working toward total workplace equality, mm-hmm. but greater is a good way to say it.
That's what fuels my belief that we're not done winning yet, Terwisha recalled. People are still asking questions. People still want to try to understand. Susan Nelson, a history teacher at Wilmer Junior High School, actually taught her students about the Wilmer 8 to teach them, quote, how a small group of people can make a lot of difference.
How when everyone participates in a group project, it actually kind of works.
What can happen when everyone participates in a group project? And that is the story of the Wilmer 8 and how they brought the National Women's Liberation Movement to Minnesota. You may clap now. Again, you can find our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also connect with us on the social medias, on the interwebs, and other digital platforms. Thank you again to the Olmsted County History Center for hosting us. Thank you so much to everyone who came. And I hope you're leaving today with a little more knowledge, a little more compassion, and a little more pride for your Minnesota ladies.
And does anyone have any questions? Like, I guess we have time if anyone has any questions.
Yes. No, we weren't able to. I would love to. Yeah. Do you have their numbers? Because I would love to talk to some people. I mean, it's just going to be me going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
It's going to be fangirling, but yeah, we'll get a question in there somewhere.
Yeah. A lot of the quotes that I found were from different newspaper articles because especially in Minnesota, you know, they were covered at the time and they are still being covered, which is fantastic. Yes. Telling, I think the humor not only helps us to cope with some of the darker aspects. These stories are pretty tame in relation to some things that we cover, but also some of the things that you know women have gone through throughout history are so absurd and so ridiculous, you almost have to laugh at it. And you have to point out the absurdity because we are still dealing with a lot of those issues and a lot of those tactics today. And I think if we can laugh about and point out how ridiculous the whole thing is, it makes it easier to confront.
Thank you.
Yes.
Not a fan of that question.
You know what? So we actually just released one that maybe it's just because we just released it, but it's one of my favorites already. We both had a lot of fun talking about the podcast. I covered Maurice Bolden. She was a 14-year-old black girl who participated and won the first national spelling bee. And then unfortunately found her, this was 50 years after the American Civil War, and she found herself the center of this racist storm to the point where her family actually had to leave. They went to Canada. Yeah. But it was so interesting to explore that history and that part of our country's history through something as innocuous as a spelling bee.
Yeah. I think mine, as cheesy as it sounds, is the woman I covered in our first episode, even though the audio is absolutely...
Please don't listen to the first one.
Yeah, we were like, don't listen to like the first five episodes. We should re-record them at some point. But the first woman I covered 5 years ago now was Sybil Ludington, who was a 15-year-old girl who basically did exactly what Paul Revere did, but farther and in the rain and at night. And no one knows who she is.
Uphill because, both ways.
Because Paul Revere's family had a lot of pull, had a lot of clout, had a lot of publicity. And she was just some 15-year-old girl from the middle of nowhere that no one really knows about. And she's like the one, I mean, a lot of the stories stick with me, but she's the one that like, every time I think about it, I still get angry. Every time I think about it, I'm like, oh, more people need to know about her.
So if you see Kelly on the street and she's like
raging, I'm just thinking about Sybil Ludington. I'm just like, oh,
yep.